Are you ready? Let's see, where do we leave off? Ridiculous, absurd, I guess. So. Yes, see the last paragraph, 263. Yes, it seems as if you have lost all virtue. Okay, we've done all that, right? As if you have fallen into debasement. It seems the same way to the woman who accepts her masculinity. I guess we've done that. The only thing I think I'd add is when he says accept your masculinity, accept your femininity, I would also put in there accept the eros you feel in getting to the woman or the man with whom you'll develop your inner masculine or feminine. So it sounds like he's lost track of eros there, but I don't think he has. In other words, to work on the anima for a man means dealing with your erotic feelings for women, and that is can be humiliating. Okay. The feminine in man's 264 is bound up with evil, meaning, and the masculine in woman's bound up with evil, meaning that to get to that, you got to go through your eros, which means profits.
Say that again?
When he says that the feminine in men is bound up with evil, I understand that to mean that to get to it, you've got to go through these complicated eros configurations, and that's what is so problematic. So he's just gone from absurdity to anima and animus, because often to integrate those two parts of ourselves, we have to accept situations that don't seem to make any sense. Now, he refers to the white bird of the soul. If you can accept the absurdity, if you can accept looking foolish, if you can accept making mistakes, if you can accept your feeling, if you can continue to ask the question of meaning, then the white bird of the soul comes to you. It is the first time that our author, our editor, did not give a footnote. And I thought I'd read you the dream that Jung had about the white bird at this time.
Memory's dream.
This is memories. Now, I'll read it, then we can talk about it. This is Memories 171. I think we're at 1913 here, if I remember correctly. We're around Christmas of 1913. Jung, in reporting this dream, says that the dream was Christmas of 1912. I wonder if he got the year right. If he did, this dream occurred a year before, or if he got his dates messed up, and so this dream would have occurred while he was working on the Red Book. I'm just not sure. So here's the dream, he says. I found myself in a magnificent Italian, is it loggia, L-O-G-G-I-A, loggia with pillars, a marble floor and a marble balustrade. I was sitting on a gold Renaissance chair. In front of me was a table of rare beauty. It was made of green stone like emerald. There I sat, looking out into the distance, for the loggia was set high up on the tower of a castle. Loggia is one of those arched, kind of arched porches. My children were sitting at the table also. Suddenly a white bird descended, a small seagull or a dove. Gracefully it came to rest on the table. And I signed to the children to be still so that they would not frighten away the pretty white bird. Immediately the dove was transformed into a little girl, about 8 years of age, with golden blonde hair. She ran off with the children and played with them among the colonnades of the castle. I remained lost in thought, musing about what I had just experienced. The little girl returned and tenderly placed her arms around my neck. Then she suddenly vanished. The dove was back and spoke slowly in a human voice. Only in the first hours of the night can I transform myself into a human being, while the male dove is busy with the 12 dead. Then she flew off into the blue air, and I awoke. Now, somewhere, unless I have completely imagined it, I believe I've read Jung saying that he equated the white dove's coming with Tony Wolf coming into his life. And it's at this point he decided to have the affair. I don't remember where I read it. I could have fabricated it, but I bet on it. I read it somewhere. I just don't remember where.
What did the bird say to him? I can only...
Only in the first hours of the night can I transform myself into a human being, while the male dove is busy with the 12 dead. As I say, as I remember it, if you ever come across it, tell me. That he felt that to get that dove to him, he had to have the affair with Tony Wolf. So there was a parallel there. I just can't remember where I would have read that. But anyway. And the 12 dead would be the collective unconscious. The part of the psyche that had been excluded from the Western mind as if it were dead. Past forms would be another way to put it. That his job was to concern himself with past forms, i.e. archetypes. That's what I recall him saying somewhere.
I
think you said the same thing in different words. Yeah. That would be one cultural manifestation.
Before my granddaughter was born, her soul appeared to me as a blue and white bird. So in that representation, the unconscious showed the bird as having a blue and a white color. And there I'm thinking of the 12 dead being represented by the blue, or the, and also Sophia is represented by that blue color. Mm-hmm. So that might be a little nod from the unconscious about the nature of soul. I don't know.
Big nod.
You know that it sees soul... a little in a different fashion.
In a much broader, deeper, and healthier fashion. Right. It's got the blue and the white.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I hope you're right. She'll have a much easier life. Well, I mentioned that because this whole bit that I've been throwing out about this material and Tony Wolf, that's my opinion. And it's sort of confirmed it. that if I didn't fabricate that memory, that he himself said this dove had to do with that experience with her.
This is slightly off subject, but what does Jung say about children's dreams? That you know, do they also have meaning? Or
oh yeah.
Okay.
He's got a whole. There's just been a book published on it called the Children's Dream Seminar.
Oh. Okay.
He gave a seminar, and I thought about even doing it here, but it's oddly edited. And maybe something we can look at sometime, I don't know. I just found it hard to read. What it is, Jung didn't, right or wrong, didn't feel children's dreams should be interpreted. That they needed the energy to cope with the world. I don't know if I agree with that or not. You know, I think a lot of these ideas he might have changed because the world's just gotten so much more complicated. He said, for example, individuation was for the second half of life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never heard that in my training. And von Franz's essay on individuation never mentions that. Anyway.
Who wrote Inner World of Childhood? Wicks?
Frances Wicks.
Yes.
Does she interpret dreams
in
there?
There's quite a few dreams in there.
Whether she interprets them to the kid or not.
She doesn't. No.
She did it to herself.
Yeah. She's talking about how the parent has to look at those dreams.
As a parent.
And think of their behavior. Right? Right. That's how I remember it.
Mm-hmm. That's been a long time since I've had that out.
That
Frances Wicks. And Inner World of Choice is wonderful. That's another one by her.
Inner World of Man, Inner World of Childhood, and Inner World of Choice.
I think some of those books she wrote when she was about 90.
Really?
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
She says a lot that's really relevant.
Yeah. But it's more of a lit than man.
You're enticing me to go get it myself. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the reason I mentioned that, in the Children's Dream Seminar, it's dreams told by adults that were remembered from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. It's a seminar, and they'll go each. It's a seminar of analysts presenting dreams of their analysands as adults remembered from childhood. And so they'll present a dream, and then they'll go on for 10 pages, blah, 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 blah. And then Jung says what it means. But why they just didn't cut out what all these other people said, which is basically never right.
I bet those dreams went through a lot of transformation as the person grew up and remembered them,
yeah,
too. Which doesn't discount that meaning, but,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm just saying that it's not the most interesting of Jung's works, I found.
Mm-hmm.
I found it irritating somehow.
I did too. I had a terrible time trying to read it.
Yeah.
I had to put it up.
And probably only 1/5 of it is Jung, and the rest of it is these seminar presentations, which are, you know, as a trainee, it would probably make you feel good. Other people have trouble with it, but reading it is a little frustrating. But yeah. You might enjoy plowing through it if you got kids and you want to see how he worked it.
You're welcome to borrow mine if you want.
Okay.
I'll be glad to bring it for you.
And even more, they're even more important than adult dreams in the sense that they tend to predict the whole child's life. Okay, let's see. So that's the white bird. Next paragraph, again, the idea, wouldn't it be nice to be able to remain respectable? But if you do walk between artificially created boundaries, you will not see the immensity of the world. And again, an idea we've said before, but we're just getting new words for it. There in the whirl of chaos dwells the eternal wonder. So what I see him doing is realizing what he's got to accept to get to the wonder, to get to the immensity, to get to his creativity, to get to the size he's going to become.
There's a beautiful song by a modern composer, Sarah McLachlan. It's called Bring On the Wonder, and it's about that, how we've pushed down, that's been pushed down for so long in us, and now it's time for it to come.
Yeah.
It's a really beautiful piece.
There was another Mary in one of the books. I think it was. She's talking about this release, I think it was. She's pregnant and she's going to have this baby. She already has an older child, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5, something. So she's having the baby at home and they let the child be in there along with the father and stuff. And at some point, the child just tears off her clothes and throws herself on her mother's bosom and says, push, mommy, push. It is my, it's just, you know, her instinctive thing
mm-hmm.
to be part of that process.
Wow. Yeah. That's the wonder, huh?
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
In trauma.
Yeah.
In trauma, yeah.
Yeah.
But what you said, what you said, pathologizing?
No.
No. Something you said made me think about those artists I was talking about. And it is as though they're pathologizing any attention to the spirit, I would say. Something you said made me think that.
I like that. That's a little.
Yeah. Do you see that in a lot of the attitude that they have? A lot of cynicism.
Yeah, well, or these artists, they pathologize it. It's either incredibly perverse or infantile, it'll be one of those two extremes.
A friend of mine did a poetry workshop this summer. She attended a different one than I did, and there were some 20-somethings in there, and all of their stuff was like that, like what you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
And she just could not understand what they were getting at.
I mean, they're expressing something that's
they
going
are.
On, for sure.
Absolutely.
They're living, you know.
But what is that?
Well, I would say it's Salome.
Okay.
But they're too arrogant to realize there's a spirit in there.
Well, they're
young.
I get something from them more confusion.
Or maybe it's confusion, but I think there's a defense against moving past a purely aesthetic experience of the material.
They're trying to find a delight in it, and yet they're embarrassed, so they have to pathologize it.
Maybe.
That's the feeling I get.
Mm-hmm.
They want to experience it, they know it's important, and yet it's humiliating because it's just not scientific.
You know what Jung's first comments were about Americans when he came here? That we're prudes and brutes, and they're two sides of the same coin.
I always want something.
They're always searching for something. Like birds of prey. And then Jung talks about how even the face of the European sort of resembles a bird of prey.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at our national bird. It's a bird of prey. Let's see. Next paragraph. Let's go the paragraph beginning with your soul. Go about halfway down that paragraph. Just as you.
Mm-hmm.
Again, nothing new. So hopefully this is just saying you should say now, okay, now I understand that. These are just different words. just as you become a part of the manifold essence of the world through your bodies, so you become a part of the manifold essence of the inner world through your soul. The way you get to your soul is through your body. This inner world is truly infinite, in no way poorer than the outer one that we know. Man lives in two worlds. A fool lives here or there, but never here and there.
I like how he's talking about the function of soul. You don't see a lot of that in his actual work. It's
no.
More personal here.
Yeah, he tries to be scientific.
Mm-hmm. I like this.
Now, apropos the old scholar, perhaps you think that a man who consecrates his life to research leads a spiritual life, and that his soul lives in larger measure than anyone else's. So he's, this is more, I think, about his professional choice. I think you can skip a little bit, get down to the end of the paragraph. He has thrown himself away in all the books and thoughts of others. Consequently, his soul is in great need. It must humiliate itself and run into every stranger's room to beg for the recognition that he fails to give her.
The way he puts things, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do know. So I don't get bored after 30 years. I'm thinking of the movie Paris, if you see it. Therefore, you see those old scholars running after recognition in a ridiculous and undignified manner. They are offended if their name is not mentioned.
Remember, there is where I work.
You work with doctors, right?
Well, it's not just doctors. The nurses are just
A friend of mine works for the health department and doing indoor air quality, and she said that the two groups that she dreads getting phone calls from are nurses and teachers, because she said in order to be successful in those professions, you have to be anal and sure of yourself. And she said, therefore, they call you, they want answers, but they already know the answers. So they want you to tell them what they know, and if you disagree, it confronts them. And she says, so instead of solving the problem, I spend 3/4 of my time telling them why they're wrong and convincing them that it's okay for them to be wrong. And she says, but I tolerate them because basically in my position, I'm an educator, so, you know, I know of what I speak, but just, she's like, she gets a call from a nurse or a teacher, she just cringes because she's like, my day's gone. Because they will argue and argue and argue until you agree with them or prove to them that they're wrong, and then you have to get past their embarrassment.
That would sound about right.
So the last few lines, just now he's telling himself why he doesn't want to be a professor. Go to the meetings of scholars and you will see them as these lamentable old men with their great merits and their starved souls, famished for recognition and their thirst which can never be slacked. The soul demands your folly, not your wisdom.
Is he describing soul as your body is encompassed in that? I mean, we can't really define what soul is or give it parameters. But is he trying to say the body is part of the soul?
I think you could almost substitute the word anima here.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Remember
that. Remember the girl was pale,
right.
Thin and pale.
Right. Okay.
Therefore, because I rise above gendered masculinity, meaning that he has accepted his eros, brought himself into contact with the woman who will teach him about his anima, and yet do not exceed the human, and he's not just doing it stupidly. The feminine that is contemptible to me transforms itself into a meaningful being.
Okay.
This is the most difficult thing, to be beyond the gendered and yet to remain within the human. So beyond the gendered would mean to have worked on the anima, worked on his inner emotional state through his contact with a woman. If you rise above the gendered with the help of a general rule, you become the same as that rule and overreach the human. Therefore, you become dry, hard, and inhuman. That is not a description of our world today. Dry, hard, and inhuman. You may go past the gender for human reasons and never for the sake of the general rule. That remains the same in the most diverse situations. So, if you act from your humanity, you act from that particular situation without general principle, with only what corresponds to the situation. Thus you do justice to the situation, perhaps at the expense of the general rule. And you know what general rule he's about to break. Then the bottom of that paragraph, for the general rule, also has meaning and has not been set up for fun. It comprises much venerable work of the human spirit. Such persons are not capable of a general principle above the gendered, but only their imagination is capable of what they have lost. Does that make sense?
Mm.
I think it's kind of a little bit what you were talking about, Carol. In a way, it sounds like he's just contradicting himself, that he's going to transcend the general rule, but then he says the general rule is important. I think he means that to say, you know, don't think you are free from the consequences of breaking what centuries of reflection on what civilized life is. Don't think you can just break that without consequences.
Well, he reminds us of that often when he talks about bringing the essential aspect of something forward.
And the importance of just ego development.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I get he's doing here.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's saying, but watch out, there are a lot of people who think they can transcend the general, but they only do so in imagination. So they talk a great story, but they don't live it. And I think that's what might be going on in that art you've described. They think they're transcending the norm, but it's only in the imagination. They don't really feel the consequences of their own material. For that, they'd have to give up their cynicism. Well, that, you know, what I would say to that, those couple sentences, just in terms of where he took it later, was he distinguishes between ego development and development of the self. And ego development, you really do help people fit in and accept the standards. Why is that important? Well, it's important for addicts who can't stop drinking. It's important for people who are can't get to work on time, who are always getting in fights at work, who are unreliable, and so on. So he's saying, don't forget that the general rule is important, but there are times when you have to transcend it in a genuine way, and also watch out for those, you know, windbags who talk about transcending it, but it's only in their imagination. Are you okay so far? Because he sort of enters into a new point in the next paragraph. It is as agonizing as a sleepless night to fulfill the beyond from the here and now, namely, the other and the opposing in myself. So what we've got now is the idea of fulfilling the beyond.
That's not the next world, though. That's his future self.
Right. Right. You know, he, in Jungian work, we kind of try to think dialectically. Namely, that there is a person to be, which exists as a potential, And what we have to do is try to apprehend that and then to put it in time and space. In other words, to accomplish our potential in time and space. Now, as I get this, the potential is the beyond. It's a potentiality.
And this is where free choice comes into being, because he can choose to move towards that or not, right? I mean, he doesn't say that here, but...
Right.
But, you know, we're told we have free choice. In the church, anyway, we're told that. And this is where that could be really a positive thing, to choose to move towards that. It's not easy, though. It's not easy either.
Right. What is the, I think the idea here that's a little new is in making your pattern real, you are fulfilling the beyond. That, this is hard. It's very abstract, if I've understood it. In other words, that pattern exists somewhere. And in our living it here, we make it firm there. We give it more substance or fill it out there. You might think of that it exists there as the structure of a snowflake. And when we live it down here, then we add water molecules, which make it a snowflake, so that something is being accrued somewhere else as we live down here.
So in that sense, it is the beyond.
Yeah.
With the big capital B.
Yes. Okay. Now,
you said accrued.
Accrued. Why even mention this? Because I think it's very abstract. And of course, I'm giving you my understanding for what it's worth. But where you might see its practical relevance is, I believe, it is what has been accrued in the beyond that affects your children.
Would that be that in different words, that it's only the consciousness that I am able to achieve here that I take with me to the beyond?
Yes, I think it could very well apply to what you take after death into the... Whatever it is.
Beyond. That's
yeah.
The word for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I really do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So you're saying that, I don't know that you're saying that at all. What I'm puzzling over is when you just said that about what the parents have that affects the children, so it's the amount of consciousness that they took and they left tasks that were left undone for us to achieve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's true, and this is, you know, again, this is very obscure, but it's like, now take what you said and look at it from the other side. What we normally say is, oh, it's what the parent achieved on earth and didn't leave undone that affects the child.
And didn't leave undone.
And did or didn't leave, either way, did or didn't leave undone. Uh-huh. And here he's just saying, yeah, and the whole time you're doing that on earth, something is being accrued over here in the beyond. And so you might say what you achieve in the earth has a reflection within you and changes the shape of your unconscious. That's what affects the child.
Is that there was a recent study that showed that families where abuse is prevalent, like domestic violence against women, for example, that the genetic structure of the children changes and that it seems to get passed on, that the propensity for getting in these kinds of relationships, so that they did a study of people who had a grandmother who was abused, never grew up in an abusive situation, but found themselves going, being attracted to men with abusive tendencies, in spite of the fact that, you know, everybody says it's environmental and that you learn it because you've lived it, and they're finding that's not true at all, that it seems to run through families and it looks like it's changing the genetic structure. So, which I think speaks to that,
that's because the way to say it.
Science says it changes the genetic structure, and Jungians say, well, duh.
Yeah, we don't know where it is, but
right,
something is different in another place between besides time and space that is developed and is passed on.
You're talking about the evolution, really, of elements within the unconscious.
Evolution of elements within the unconscious. Also change. We seek to make the unconscious potential real here, and as we do that, that retroflects back and shifts the structure of the unconscious. And it's that structure of the unconscious which touches the unconscious of the child and makes the biggest impact. In other words, it's not only what you do, it's what you are. That makes sense? I wouldn't have gotten into it except he says it.
Sometimes my kids will tell me, you know, say, wow, where'd you learn that? And they'll say, oh, I knew that before I was born.
Uh-huh.
And it's like they're, you know, they're pulling something that they have access to because nobody's told them they shouldn't have access
to
it.
Or you could say, putting that in different words, there's a communication unconscious to unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what he's getting at here.
So remember in the last study we did, the woman, when she finally gets that flower developed as it's supposed to be, it fits into this bigger pattern.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then that explodes into something different. This is a similar idea.
Very similar.
Each of us fulfills our pattern that fits into this whole larger matrix.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And that will become something over time that we'll never see.
You're talking about the cave scene and the living symbol.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I ran across something in some of my old writings when it was all up in my head, which I can't know. But I had written, when I die, there will be music, and it's like another note will be added to the score, mm-hmm. the symphony that's already there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Same idea, I think. You're putting it in a cosmic framework, but I think it also exists in an individual framework where it affects your immediate family. That's my attempt to interpret that statement. He doesn't say that. But.
There's a prayer that I like, that a piece of it is, give me the freedom to grow so that I might become the fulfillment of the seed that was planted in me at my making.
Mm-hmm.
And that really speaks to me in terms of what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
There's something there when you come into this world.
Mm-hmm.
That is my task too.
Yeah, and that when you do it in the world, something is being, like a tree in you, is it's growing.
And that affects future and past, because if you're left with a piece of your parents' puzzle to deal with, then you're affecting change in the past, too, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Certainly the effects, the past's effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
And it could even be that you're healing your parents.
Yeah.
It could very well be. Does he?
Yeah, he does in one of his books about the redemption of the parish.
I've seen
some. That I can't prove it, but there's something in me that says that.
And the redemption in the other world.
Yes.
I've seen that several times. Parents come back different in the dream than they were ever known, and they thank the person for their work, and they said, because over here it's making a difference.
Well, look at what Jung said. His father came back shortly before his mother died.
Right.
And asked him to tell him about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And Jung later said, you know, he knew my mom was coming, so he better figure this out. He didn't figure it out while he was here.
I like that. That's why I think he brings in this beyond.
That's such a nicer, for me, a better word than heaven. The beyond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen that in dreams several times. That we go, that something in us goes somewhere at death.
It's beyond.
And it's beyond.
It's just that mystery.
Yeah. And, you know, that's all I can say.
Yes.
I've just seen it, and so who knows?
I've seen that in the physical world. As a nurse, I've been with hundreds of people that have died. And I am not, over the course of my nursing career, I went from being very religious to being not very religious to being kind of religious. But the one thing I am certain of is that death isn't the end. And it's because of the feelings that I have when I'm
Did you read about that study where this guy was measuring the body to see if anything left at death, to see if the soul had weight? Have you read about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're thinking that there's a few ounce difference.
Yeah, there's like this, it was even less than that, but they're finding that there was actually this physical, unaccountable loss of something physical.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
They're also doing some work on whether once your brain shuts down and we don't have consciousness anymore, whether the cells actually have some consciousness in their own apartment. So there's interesting theoretical what exactly
happens. Well, I had a dream not long after my dad died that I was attending my grandfather, who I didn't know, that I was attending his funeral, and that it was very elaborate production, and he and my dad ended up putting on a stage show, and everyone says that I have a lot of personality traits similar, but there were a lot of issues with those traits, and you know, and so I'm telling my dad, oh, I don't know if I want to do, you know, is this my legacy? And he, and in the dream, he said, no, you're my legacy. I mean, in that you have the choice, but it was a really pivotal time because it meant that I had to change a lot. And I went, you know, through this whole, but it was really a neat dream because it was like both of them were coming back and saying, you have the opportunity to change this. And I was left with a feeling when I woke up that if I changed it for me, that I changed it for them, that they could have peace if I could find peace. Because of what they left me. And so, but I still had to do all the work. Did they offer 1 ounce of work? No, and that would be just like my dad. Yeah, this is great, you know, he's ultimate Tom Sawyer. Here, paint that fence.
Well, you get the idea that, I think, that what Jung is dealing with, on the one hand, is this idea of the beyond, the bigger picture, destiny, identity, meaning, creating a personality that has a place in the world on the one hand, and this darn passion stuff on the other. And he's working with how do these two fit together. Well, I feel that's enough for one day. So we got to the beyond, which would be middle of the page, page 264. And I think I had you read to 267. We won't get any we won't get past that. But I continue to enjoy it. I hope you do.
Mm-hmm.
It's dense as heck, but...
Just for the language alone.
Uh-huh.
You know, the way he puts things.
Mm-hmm.
He's very poetic.
So we'll pick up with that in 2 weeks. You all got the dates for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I'll see you in 2 weeks.
All right.